Bibles to the book of Proverbs. We will be picking several of our points out of chapter 6. And obviously, as our study has continued and gone through, we have been using different passages throughout the book of Proverbs and tying together the theme. If we go back just briefly before we do a kind of a quick look back, what was the opening discussion we had on the book of Proverbs? The phrase that applied the most, and I think it's key as it looks at all of the topics that we've studied thus far, the fear of the Lord is what? The beginning of knowledge, okay? And as we look at these different topics that we've covered, many of them have been presented by, obviously, Solomon and the other wise men of that day, compiled together to teach the children of Israel an appreciation for the fear of the Lord, an appreciation for basic fundamental behaviors that were considered to be consistent with fearing the Lord and would be driven by fear of the Lord to do things that are correct. And by God's nature in and of itself, God is holy. Activities that correlate and parallel godly behavior, holy behavior, fit with that same idea. So in our study today, as I mentioned on Wednesday night, the next topic that we were going to study were things that were abominable to the Lord or are abominable to the Lord. And there's a particular passage that's quoted in the book of Proverbs that talks about seven things in particular. But we could go throughout compiling lists of things that have been commanded or stated that God does not want us to be involved in, that we could all say, because he's commanded us not to do those, they're contrary to his will, his nature, and he detests them because they're sinful. But if we look at this group of seven, in many ways, they tie together in a manner that indicates that, you know, these are kind of at the heart of the matter, so to speak. In this study, we're going to tie together using the word abomination, abhor. So if we're looking at abominable, it's not necessarily a word we use every day. It means detestable. We don't use detestable every day. You know, I don't go around saying, I detest this. Unless it's a certain type of food, we generally say we don't like it. But dislike doesn't carry the same connotation to us when we hear something, I abhor this, I detest this. It carries a much stronger idea and conveys a much stronger idea than, oh, I don't like that. Well, if there are things that I don't like that I'll eat, you know. But there are things that I detest that I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. So there's it's important for us to understand here, abominable, abhorrent, detestable, very, very strong. Very, very strong in the way that God views these things. It's not that he doesn't like them and he'll tolerate them. He completely wants them to be foreign to our behavior. When we hear it, we get the sense of something that's completely unpleasant and totally to be avoided. The list we will be studying is characterized all of the nations and people whom God has judged through history. If you look at some of the major prophets and the prophecies that are made against nations that have gone against God's will, gone against his nature, how they worshiped idols, how they were judged as a result of their behavior. Their behavior was abhorrent, detestable, abominable. When we look at the Amorites, their wickedness was great. The fact that they led the children of Israel astray into sexual immorality after they came out of Egypt. They were later judged as a nation because of that. We see Babylon, we see Syria, we see Assyria, all of those nations because of their behaviors being judged because their behavior in general was abominable to the Lord. We can expect to find a similar judgment if we find these characteristics in our own lives. And that's probably, as we go through this entire study today, God has used these as a standard of abomination to judge people, nations, and individuals. And he will do likewise with us going forward. Things that are abominable to the Lord. In Proverbs 6, 16 through 19, there are six things the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination. Now, I don't think that this implies that the seventh one is an abomination. He is listing a group of seven. And symbolically, when we talk about seven and 12 and certain numbers throughout the Bible, they're symbolic of completeness. So these are seven things that are completely abominable to the Lord. It's a group that identifies probably a core behavior and a core characteristic. He starts with haughty eyes. Other translations will say a proud look, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. Now, that's not necessarily a list that is the same as what we would see in, say, the Ten Commandments, is it? Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not bear false witness. Now, that one is listed, because bearing false witness is listed here. It doesn't talk about drinking. It doesn't talk about sexual immorality. It doesn't talk about specific sins, does it? But many of these things all go to the root of those, do they not? Yeah, they do. We look at the core behavior, particularly as it relates to a lying tongue, you know, and the attitudes that go behind lying. We'll look at those in deeper, but all of those become, you know, kind of a foundation for many other sins. A proud look. In Proverbs 6 and 17, a proud look or haughty eyes. What do we think characterizes a proud look? Or someone that is haughty. What would you, in your own words, what would you describe that to be? Arrogance? Okay. I'm better than you are. Thinks a whole lot about themselves. Walks around with their nose in the air, so to speak. A bit highbrow. Those are all terms that we use in our own language to describe someone that would... We don't go around saying they have haughty eyes today. That's just another word we use. So it's important for us to tie it together with what we do use. We might say a proud look, but it's not necessarily in my common language. In Proverbs 16 and 5, everyone who is arrogant in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Be assured he will not go unpunished. If I'm arrogant in my own heart, what am I likely to do? If I think I'm better than everybody else, what will I likely be, that will that attitude likely drive me to do? Force your will on everybody else. Bully your way through a conversation. We've talked about crucial conversations in our past. It goes to how an individual interacts with everyone else and interacts with God, because if I think that I'm right, I'm going to do my will and not God's will. So he makes the point here that is arrogant in heart. Now, as an individual thinks in his heart, what is he? So is he. So if I am arrogant in my heart, what's it going to manifest itself in general? I'm arrogant in my lifestyle, how I go about conducting myself with others, and in how I conduct myself in relationship to my Creator. What's the outcome that's made here? He says, that key word, an abomination. Strongly as it's related to this. If I am arrogant in my heart, it's an abomination to the Lord. As a result, much like the nations that were surrounding Israel were punished because of their behavior, what can I expect for myself? I can expect punishment in eternity if I allow that to be my lifestyle. Brent? That's correct.
So, thoughts. You know, God would look at me, and you know, if from my heart I do these things, someone may say, well, you know, so and so's got a good heart. Well, not if they're not truly, if they're committing these sins, it's coming from their will. But that defiles us, and you know, this passage, it's an abomination.
That's correct. What's in our heart comes out, it defiles us, as it's mentioned in Matthew. I think we have that mentioned in it later in here, is an individual who is practicing devising evil plans. So, good point. Thank you. An attitude of superiority toward others or God's word is polar opposite to humility. We've studied about humility in our class as well. And a characteristic that Solomon was advising, quote, his son to embody in their lifestyle. If we're not humble, we don't recognize our need for God. Luke 18, 9 through 14, the story of the publican and the Pharisee clearly exhibits this behavior and who is acceptable in God's sight. The two men were going up to pray, and the publican says, "Forgive me, for I am a sinner." And what does the Pharisee say? He was glad he wasn't like that sinner. First off, that exhibits what? Arrogance with respect to the other individual. It exhibits also the absence of recognition that he had a need for God. Because he didn't ask for forgiveness for his sins. He just said, "Thank you for me not being like this other individual." Whose opinion was expressed in that view? His, not God's. God's attitude is that all men have sinned and as a result need him. And humility drives us to view that in our lives and recognize it as a key part of our lives. Philippians 2:2-3, we are to imitate Christ's humility. So if we're looking at the opposite to a proud look or an arrogance of heart, it's to imitate Christ's humility. Christ, being deity, humbled himself in what way? Humbled himself to allow himself to be a sacrifice for mankind on the cross in a way which was the most cruel and gruesome way that at that time that an individual could be killed. A lying tongue. It's the second one that's listed in Proverbs 6 and 17. Proverbs 12 and 22, lying lips are an abomination to the Lord. No punches pulled there. It's just point blank. How do we lie? Oftentimes we think about it from the standpoint of just coming out and point blank lying. That's pretty bold flow. We say it's a bold-faced lie. But do we tailor our responses to paint our situation in a better light? And we could think up a lot of what-if scenarios, but let's say I've got a new chip in my windshield and there's a crack that's been there for 6 months, and the crack's not covered by insurance, but the chip is. But if I claim that the two of them are done at the same time, I can get it covered. Well, I kind of tailored that in a better light to get the whole thing replaced, did I not? That's a lying tongue. Do we, as a small child, Cain changed the subject when he was asked about his brother. Am I my brother's keeper? When God asked him what happened to his brother, did Cain know what had happened to his brother? Absolutely. Did he try to deflect the situation and paint himself in a better light? Absolutely. Does a child omit details when they know that they're going to get in trouble? Absolutely, they do. They will paint themselves in a better light or, you know, change the subject in every which way until they learn that that's not the behavior that is acceptable. I mean, it's part of growing up and learning what to do is to always tell the truth. In Acts 5 and 1 through 11, what did Ananias and Sapphira do? They sold property and laid the money at the apostles' feet, did they not? When they were doing this, what were they doing? They were painting themselves in a better light, were they not, in how they portrayed it? What did they do wrong in this? Well, it was theirs to keep back. They made like it was everything. Lying lips to portray themselves in a better light in a way that encouraged others to think more of them than they truly should have. When they were point blank pressed about it, what did they do? They dug in like that child, stood with their lie, and as a result lost their lives associated with it. Did they have an opportunity to correct the matter? Yes. Particularly Sapphira. And she didn't take advantage of it. Let us not be one that would fail to take advantage of our opportunities. Hands that shed innocent blood. This is not one that we're going to be faced with on a day-to-day environment. We're not generally murderers by nature. It's probably the farthest. But when we look at the world as a whole and the wickedness that exists, there are areas that come to play that this is important to look at. It goes to the idea of the sanctity of life. Who created life? God did. Life was created in whose image? God's image. As a result, how is it to be viewed? As holy. Okay. 1 Kings 21, the murder of Naboth, is an example of the shedding of innocent blood. In particular, what did Jezebel do? She conspired to have Naboth killed so that they could take his property. Genesis 9 and 6, whoever sheds the blood of a man by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. And we've already made that point. Shedding of innocent blood was punishable by death. One of the Ten Commandments was point blank. Thou shalt not kill. Melvin? We're going to get there. Next point, I think. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that their children come out, but there is no harm, what was the punishment? They would pay restitution, were they not? And it was to be the restitution that was named by the woman's husband and imposed by the judges to determine. You follow the tail end of that verse, though, and there's a different outcome. But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. So if the child was injured and he lost an eye, what was the punishment? The one that caused it could lose an eye. If that child lost its arm as a result of that accident, what could happen to the one that caused it? Lose an arm. We see that pretty plain in this. If I caused the death of that unborn child, what did I have to pay? My life. There is no other parallel in this passage that fits with relation to how God views the sanctity of life of an unborn child. Now, that was an accidental striving in the death of a child. How much more is God going to punish someone that makes an intentional death of an unborn child? He expects us to respect life and to choose to do otherwise and to choose to go against his belief on that. It's absolutely an abomination to him. Abortion certainly fits the definition. The unborn cannot be any more innocent. They've never done anything to harm anyone. They've never lied. They've never committed a sin. They can't be any more innocent than they are, or indefendable. They can't defend for themselves. Who has to defend for them? Those that are in control. Mercy killing is not condoned. Now, this is hard when you see someone totally suffering to not want to end their suffering. And I will make a distinction here. I believe that in a scenario where an individual cannot be maintained by their own, it is allowed, appropriate to allow nature to run its course. But when there's an individual that we know a way to help that person, we choose to do it not, we go against the contrary nation of helping that innocent party. So I think there's a distinction there. Elder abuse in the form of withholding basic care fits this definition. You know, allowing a parent to lay in their own filth and develop bed sores and die as a result of it would be an abomination to the Lord, because that person can't care for themselves. Proverbs 15 and 26. As we look at an individual that devises wicked plans, the thoughts of the wicked are an abomination to the Lord. Now, in general, that states to the nature of an individual that is planning and is doing sinful behavior on a regular basis. They are viewed as wicked, and as a result, they're abominable to the Lord. In Proverbs 1, 11 through 13, if they say, "Come with us, let us wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without reason. Like Sheol, let us swallow them alive and whole. Like those who go down to the pit, we shall find all precious goods. We shall fill our houses with plunder." That's the beginning of this passage where, you know, basically people are plotting to commit murder so that they can take the goods of another individual. If we look to the New Testament, we have a parable that describes this very behavior. What happened to the individual that the Good Samaritan took care of? He was ambushed and robbed and left for dead. In Acts 23:20-21, what did the Jews plot to do in relationship to Paul? 40 of them plotted together and weren't going to take food or anything until he was dead. And the plot was revealed, and Paul was taken at the hands of the Romans and protected to another location. The Jews brought false witness against Christ in that he blasphemed God. They devised wicked plans. Now, the devising of wicked plans here goes to premeditation, does it not? It's not an accidental thing. I didn't accidentally do this. I planned it ahead of time. And we can do that in the behavior of any sin. We can plot to do something in our behavior or put us in a position to where we're going to be prone to do that. We've devised wicked plans. The adulterer and adulteress that book a getaway months in advance, they can spend time together, have devised wicked plans. That's different than something that just happens in the instant of a moment of two people being near each other in proximity. Not to say that either is right, but oftentimes in the instance of a moment, we will make worse decisions than we will if we've been planning it and plotting it and thinking about it for a long period of time. Premeditation is much more grave than an instant misdiscretion. Heart that devises wicked plans. Premeditated wickedness is abhorred by God. God condemned David in the matter of Uriah. What did David conspire to do? Have Uriah killed to hide his own sin. As a result, he paid penalties throughout the rest of his life. He did not give his life for Uriah's life. Much because he was already set in position to be of the lineage of the Christ and so on. But he paid penalty of family troubles, nation troubles, throughout the rest of his reign. We displease God when we attempt to cover or divert attention to our own disobedience. Well, he conspired to hide his own sin with Bathsheba by getting Uriah to come in and be with his wife. And then he plotted to have Uriah killed and premeditatedly put him at the front of the battle and pull back from it. And the sad part about that story is, think about how many other co-conspirators David implicated in this. The commanders that pulled back from Uriah and let him live, let him die, were as complicit as David was. Children stash things out of their parents' sight as an example of devising wicked plans and trying to hide their own sin. Individuals conspire not to rat each other out. It's kind of the League of Nations of, you know, co-conspirators, is we're not going to rat on each other. All of that goes to the idea of premeditation and devising wicked plans. Feet that run to mischief. This goes to the idea of I have a propensity to get into trouble. I put myself in a way that runs toward mischief. I head toward it. I don't go the other direction. Proverbs 15:9, the way of the wicked is an abomination to the Lord. Proverbs 3:32, for the devious person is an abomination to the Lord, but the upright are in his confidence. Direct contrast in behavior. Proverbs 11:20, those of crooked heart are an abomination to the Lord, but those of blameless ways are his delight. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. He makes the point here. This is the crooked heart. It's the way that person views life and goes about life. They have a tendency to run toward the wrong things. Proverbs 15:8-9, the way of the wicked is an abomination to the Lord, but he who loves him who pursues righteousness. If we're not prone to run to mischief, what are we going to be doing if we're compliant with God's laws? We're going to be pursuing righteousness. We're going to be blameless in our behavior. That's not going to mean that we're not going to make a mistake and we're going to sin. But if I sin, what do? I correct it. Okay? We are upright if we're avoiding mischief and running toward it. A false witness. We talked about earlier lying, but I think the false witness is much more heinous than just outright lying about something, because you've plotted in particular to take advantage of another person. I might lie just to get benefit on my own, but if I tell a lie about somebody else to get them in trouble, I have particularly done something that is abhorrable. In 1 Kings 21, individuals conspired to falsely accuse Naboth. What did they say Naboth had done? He had blasphemed the king. And they were going to, he had done things that would actually get him killed according to the law. And as a result, he was killed. They brought together false witnesses against Naboth to have these things said about him. The Jews brought false witness against Jesus. Okay? It goes from lying to benefit ourselves or lying to harm another. It's particularly abhorrent for that reason. One who sows discord. In Psalms 133:1, unity among God's people is desired. This would have been unity as the psalmist here is talking to the children of Israel. And it's as equally applicable to Christians today and how we're unified in heart in serving the Lord so that we can serve Him faithfully. Proverbs 26:20-21. For the lack of wood, the fire goes out. Where there is no whisper, quarreling ceases. As charcoal to hot embers and wood to fire, so is a quarrelsome man for kindling strife. An individual that sows discord can do it for many reasons. Somebody that's sowing discord can do it for the purpose of deflecting attention to themselves in their own behavior. You know, if I divide things and get people to quarreling amongst themselves, maybe they won't pay attention to me. Some people just like to see a good stir, and they'll stir up strife as a result of it. That's an individual that, in the nature of their heart, is wicked in their heart. Proverbs 16:28, a dishonest man spreads strife, and a whisperer separates close friends. If we sow discord amongst our fellow brethren, we're going to separate friends, are we not? We are. Now, does that mean we avoid all controversy? No. We are commanded to deal with certain things. If there is error in the Lord's body, we have to deal with that. That's not to be confused with sowing discord. That's keeping the church pure. It may feel the same because there's similar emotions tied into that. There's contention that arises. There's hard discussions that have to be had. And there's going to be parties that are on two sides of the subject. But sowing discord is separate from teaching the truth. Other things that Jehovah abhors, and there's, as we indicated, you could do a litany list of things that are condemned as sins. But in particular, other passages that use the word abominable or an abomination, there's a few other things that are listed outside of this group of seven. We've already mentioned in the book of Proverbs, he's condemned those who used false weights because they were taking advantage of the people that they were interacting in business with and trade. Proverbs 11:1, a false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. Those who blur moral distinctions. In Proverbs 17:15, he who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the just, both of them are alike an abomination to the Lord. Someone that's blurring the moral distinctions here, or defending someone who is in their sinfulness, and condemning the righteous person who is trying to teach and get that person to correct their lives because they're teaching them the truth, is abhorred by God. Because they're blurred the sanctity of the scriptures in their behavior. They blurred the intent of the teaching of God in their behavior. I would say that the idea of blurring moral distinctions fits to the idea of watering down the gospel and making it more palatable to the humanistic world that we live in. well, I've got to appeal to a broader base, so we won't teach about this over here. I won't talk about homosexuality because I don't want to distance myself from somebody that may not be a practicing homosexual, but they agree that it's okay in their lifestyle. Or when it relates to the scriptural standing on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And that's a sticky subject there. It's a lot of emotion tied up in that. Well, I don't want to talk about that. We've blurred the moral distinction associated with it if we don't teach about it. Worship of the wicked is another area where Jehovah abhors behavior. The sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination to the Lord. Okay. Why is it abhorrible? Because they're not obedient in the first place and they're not doing that sacrifice in sincerity to God. They're just practicing the sacrifice. They're filling the pew because it feels like the right thing to do. But are they offering the sacrifice in the honesty and sincerity of their heart to truly give their lives over to God when outside the building we're misbehaving? Proverbs 28:9. One who turns away his ear from hearing the law, even his prayer is an abomination. God doesn't want to hear our prayers. If we're living our lives in a way that we are wicked and continuing in that wickedness and have no real idea of being penitent in our hearts, because it's meaningless in offering that prayer. Thoughts and comments on things that are abominable to the Lord. I appreciate your attention today. We've got one more class in our study of Proverbs. Our study next time will be Wednesday night. And as I indicated last Wednesday night, we'll be studying the way of the transgressor is hard.